Yeah, King Rose or Urge Overkill.
And I'm International Cato.
You met at Northwestern. You had an EP in 86, a full length in 89. You've been through a lot of producers. You've covered a couple of songs. And I've my first thing I want to ask you, when you were forming this band, did you have any inkling it was going to go anywhere?
We weren't hanging our hats on anything. It's just what we wanted to do.
But I think intoxicants of any type tend to lead to unrealistic thinking. And, you know, given the time that we spent together drinking or otherwise under the influence, yes, by the cold light of day, it seemed obvious that there was no structure for us to jump into. There was no such thing as a career in the punk rock world. You were going to have that as a lifestyle and as sort of an art project. So, but I think against the odds, we did have very unrealistic, and a lot of the people we know who ended up going anywhere had these incredibly unrealistic ideas about where they were headed. You have to have patently unrealistic ideas to get anywhere, especially at that time.
Yeah, and I recall, I don't know if the King recalls, but I do. It was sort of a blood brother pact we made one drunken evening. I met the King, and we thought we had a good thing going. And then I don't know if I was pissing off personally or he was disillusioned with what we were about. But Ed spoke about maybe starting his own band, and leaving the team. And I did my darndest to talk him out of it. And he looked at me and said, I'll stay in this band if we take it straight to the top. And which I never had considered. Like I didn't know what the top was, but that was his, that seemed to be his demand.
There were late night proclamations involved.
Well, think of it this way. 1986, you're still in the middle of New Wave and the Romantic era.
But no, Dennis, we hated all that at the time. We didn't really listen to it. We didn't know which way the wind was blowing, the pop music world. We just burrowed deep underground and we're listening to all sorts of insane punk rock, like, Black Flag and DKs and, Flipper and, all that crazy shit. And we were pissed off. We were, young, pissed off, out of control. And so, we felt safe underground and, letting all that fluff, 80s fluff blow over, MTV, all that,
We were lucky enough to be exposed from these freaks from Detroit, Corey and Lisa, through Touch and Go Records. And we had ended up that Steve was hanging around Northwestern, and he kind of had his own, aesthetic. He was from Montana, and I think he played briefly with a band. He played briefly with a band with Al Jorgensen, who also was from Montana, who had this, they sort of had what we thought maybe would lead to some future, however small.
Where was the sea change? Where was that moment? Because you're on Touch and Go, right? And you aspire to the best of the best on that label. But somebody kicked you up a ladder somewhere where you suddenly have a Butch Vig and an Al Beanie and, you know, and you're in a different league. So who was the human being? Was it a manager? Was it, you know, an A&R guy? Who actually turned to you and said, okay, you know what? You're at a point here where you actually can take this thing beyond the people that you thought would be the biggest and the best you'd ever get to.
I had a relationship with Beth at the time, who was working for other labels. She was interested in she was working in the music industry pop proper, which we didn't understand that with a little effort, it wasn't going to be us that did it, but and Touch and Go.
We did not understand the business at all.
Touch and Go also didn't have a relationship with, but there were college radio stations that were part of a network, and there were a couple publications called CMJ and Rockpool. And Beth, our current manager and, you know, my life partner ended up, you know, she was very skeptical upon hearing our very first record, Jesus Earth Superstar, but she did hear what we were trying to do. She was one of the few people who heard what we were trying to do and was like, well, why don't we send this to Rockpool? If we sent this to CM, someone's going to have to do it. Touch and Go wasn't going to do it. Somebody had to believe in the band. We had somebody outside of the band who understood that there was a structure that existed and there were college radio stations who existed that could help us organize being recognized internationally. The important thing to remember is that we had been a functioning touring band that was chosen by, you know, Nirvana to go on the road. We had played shows with Big Black. We had played shows with Sonic Youth. We had put out records that were self, you know, we didn't have A&R people. We didn't have producers. We were responsible for our first three LPs. So by the time, you know, and Beth had been around the block, by the time we had basically any label who we wanted to sign with, we could have signed with. And we were pretty savvy by the time that was happening. And we didn't get into the situation where we were shanghaied by some label and we just didn't know what, you know, they threw some money at us and we were just like, okay, whatever. You know, we weren't a new band. We already had our aesthetic. We had ideas about what aesthetic we wanted to move into. And we had very specific demands about artistic control and control of our videos and all that.
You've had a lot of sounds over the years. You've evolved. And then you go, you know what? We're going to make our first record in a long, long, long time, almost a decade. How do you wake up in the morning and go, okay, what is this going to be? What is that? Back to the coffee shop. Who calls who? And what is that discussion?
Well, I think what kickstarted it was just, you know, just simple, you know, domestic boredom. Like, hey, we have this great band on our hands. Like, maybe we should get back to that. But, you know, we did not see the sands of time slipping through the hourglass or anything. But it just felt like the time. And, you know, we hadn't been in the city. It didn't feel like a decade. But you know, the older you get, the quicker time seems to slip by. And we were just like, yeah, let's. You know, it's like, you know, what do you got? You know, I got this. What do you got? You know, and we just, you know, started kicking it around again.
I mean, a part of it is both of us we stayed in Chicago. We're around and our old fan, plenty of people around here. It's like Urge's favorite band. And you couldn't go anywhere without people saying, like, what's wrong with you guys? Why did you break up at your height? You don't want to go into the story. It's a sob story. You know, it's a misunderstanding. And that led to, we had a mutual friend around town. And what we didn't wake up and say, we're making another Urge record. That was a very slow thing that came about from agreeing to do one reunion show. And then we did another, we did some touring, and we were sort of like, you know, playing the old songs is boring. We had new songs, and that took a long time to that wasn't a decision. That was like a very natural process.
Which one of you was listening to the radio and suddenly Wham, I should say George Michael / Wham comes on and you go, you know, if we Urge Overkill that sucker, we're really going to mess with it.
Well, of course we were both listening. We were in the back.
We were just on tour in Europe and you know, I mean, you know how crazy Radio Free Europe is. You know, anything goes. And yeah, we were just, you know, leaving like Moscow or something, driving out, and you know, our PM driver just had the radio on, and we both, I mean, our ears just perked up. You know, pricked up, like, what the f*** is this? You know, it was obviously some fluffy 80s hit, but we didn't know who it was or anything. But we were both just, I mean, we're like, turn it up. And we both were just gobsmacked. And, we, you know, it wasn't until we got back to the States that we, you know, we tried to find it. You know, only operative word, freedom, that's all we remembered from it. And we found it. And we're like, and for our astonishment, it was, you know, George Michael and Wham, like, whatever. I mean, it could have been Haircut 100 or, you know, Oingo Boingo, you know. It was a song, though. It was so undeniably catchy.
Big label freedom, omnivore, catalog label mainly. Interesting choice. Did they come to you? Did you go to them?
Yeah, we did have a finished record that we kind of shopped around, and we kind of liked what they were doing, and they really took to it, and that was important to us. I think they really understood what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
So why do you think you can still get away with this kind of music in today's world? Well, I mean, come on, really. Why do you think you can get away with this?
Because we don't give a goddamn that anyone else is listening to. I mean, we've never licked our finger and, you know, held it in the wind, which way it was blowing. I mean, we've just always pretty much just made music that, you know, made us happy, and we only could hope would make other people happy. I guess, you know, you were talking about, you know, the boat analogy. I mean, the good ship Urge, it's still afloat. It's, you know, we never know quite, you know, where it's being steered, but we're both aboard. We are both aboard. And, you know, we're always, you know, the King and I have always been, you know, curious, like, you know, which trajectory the wind might send this, you know, good ship Urge. And we're always, you know, more than not pleasantly surprised.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. So it's two of your songs on either side as the theoretical bread. And then you get to pick a bunch of songs that go in between.